KALW.
There's a thing in glass that half of the people believe that it's a craft. The other half of the people believe that it's a luxury medium.
Today, we hear how one studio is working to make glass blowing more approachable.
Glass blowing, in general, has a long-standing history of being like a hot, sweaty place for men.
The art of making glass. Then we get an update from Superintendent Matt Wayne of the San Francisco Unified School District.
And so we have to make some tough decisions about how we're using those resources to provide the educational opportunities our students deserve.
And El Cerrito author Maya Ely reads from her new book.
It's an illustrated visual glossary that provides high-level definitions of terms and historical events to aid in understanding race and the Black experience in America.
It's new arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour, and more. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. If you think about glass blowing, it's hot, it can be dangerous. To do it, you need a lot of space, special equipment, and a giant furnace. And all that might make it seem like a hassle, and therefore inaccessible as a hobby. But at one arts organization in San Francisco, they're trying to change that image by inviting people in to learn the practice. KALW's Molly Blair Salyer went to check it out.
I didn't expect the sound of glass being made to be so loud. I'm at Public Glass, a nonprofit glass art studio and school in a warehouse in Bayview. The space is lofty and industrial, but made cozy by all the people at work and the persistent heat of the 2,000-degree furnace, where a giant cauldron of glass is kept molten hot all year long. The main studio is called the Hot Shop.
I'm going to take it pretty slow. We kind of go through each of the motions pretty easily.
Ethan Castillo teaches beginner classes.
Oh, we're doing flowers.
Ethan demonstrates the process for his students, who seem a little nervous.
I'll be there every step of the way.
The first step is to get some glass to work with.
And here's the fun part. Follow me.
He opens the furnace door, and instinctively everyone steps back. Even from a safe distance, you can feel the intense heat.
Whoa.
Ethan dips a long metal pole into the furnace, and when it reemerges, there's a squishy gob of hot glass on the end.
Once it's out of the furnace, it has a nice, warm, voluptuous kind of glow to it, and it has a really nice kind of movement.
He walks the glass on the pipe over to a glory hole.
Last but not least, we have a reheating chamber over here.
It's a mini furnace that looks a little like a pizza oven.
So that's why you go back inside, right? Because you're losing all that heat.
Ethan puts the glass tip pipe in the glory hole and turns the pole. This helps the glass to stay hot so it can be shaped.
So yeah, the goal is to keep it turning constantly.
Glass art is a bit of a race. You have to keep turning the metal pipe that the hot glass is attached to, or gravity will intervene.
We can see how that flower comes to life.
On the other side of the furnace, I meet Herb Dang, who's working on a bowl.
I have the cup in there, which I'm going to pick up and blow out to a bigger vessel.
Herb grew up in Bayview and has been at Public Glass since the early 2000s. He works industrial day jobs, but was making glass beads at home as his personal passion. It maybe wasn't the best idea.
When you work at home and, you know, basically I would make things and then realized I didn't have enough ventilation and I could see the deposits on the inside of my ceilings from the gases.
That's the thing about glass. You can't do it in your house like painting. You need access to some really big, heavy, hot, expensive stuff. And that's the reason Public Glass was born.
Part of the idea of this place was to have a publicly accessible studio.
Public Glass was founded in 1996 by three students from the California School of Arts and Crafts. Once they graduated, they didn't have a way to practice their passion.
But the people who started this place, and they were the ones teaching, their friends who already went to school were teaching, and that way they'd pay off teachers by saying, oh, you do an hour teaching, you get an hour of time. For me, teaching, I got time.
Time in a well-equipped studio was a big draw for artists.
And so it was a way of sort of turning what you knew into time in the shop, even if you couldn't afford it. I mean, it's not cheap to blow glass.
They also started offering classes to the senior center down the block and the neighborhood schools as a way to connect with the community.
You know about the Welcome to Bayview sign?
Herb is talking about these huge three-dimensional letters on 3rd Street that spell out the word Bayview, welcoming folks to the neighborhood.
So we broke up all this ceramic tile and then created the sign. And then we've been trying to get a sign out here, I think the Bayview Merchants, for about 30 years.
Public Glass is still committed to working with the community through its classes and this ethos of education. Even Herb, who's been doing this for decades, still sees his art as a learning practice.
So it's a great way just to clear the mind and be present in the now. It really entails focus. You can't think about anything else. You respond to what's happening in front of you, otherwise you lose it.
There's a kind of metaphor for life in this idea.
If you don't pay attention, it either bites you or it goes away. And one of the things everybody learns in all these shops, it's heading for the floor, don't get in its way. Don't grab for anything falling, because if it's too cold, it'll cut you. And if it's hot, it'll burn you. You let it hit the floor, and then you figure out what you're doing.
Figuring out what they're doing next is Marty Gorski's job. Marty is a management consultant working with Public Glass. She first came to the studio as an artist in 2017.
When I came into the shop the first time, it was all women working in the studio, and I was like, this is kind of seems like the place I want to be.
Marty started her glass art practice in college, where she began to understand the industry as being a pretty male-dominated place.
I think that glass blowing in general has a long-standing history of being like a hot, sweaty place for men. The terminology is very reflective of that, especially in the hot shop. Our reheating station is called the glory hole. You can jack the neck, you can paddle the bottom.
Public Glass is working to be radically inclusive in making glass art accessible. Part of the challenge to doing so is that it's so expensive. And that, in turn, has an effect on how the art is perceived.
There's a thing in glass that half of the people believe that it's a craft. The other half of the people believe that it's a luxury medium.
Yet glass is something we interact with all the time.
We use glass in all sorts of facets of our life, from your drinking glasses, plates, and your windows, your buildings, your smart glass, your phone. It's very much around us.
The mission of Public Glass is to translate that idea of universal use into universal access. They offer classes, studio space to experienced artists, and scholarships so more people can learn the craft. Marty takes me back to the hot shop, where Ethan and his students are finishing their class.
Did you guys want to give it a try?
Yeah.
While Public Glass has been going strong for nearly 30 years, it faces many of the same challenges as other nonprofits, like consistent funding for all their programs, not to mention their astronomical utility bill. But Marty says they seem to have found their rhythm with the perpetual nature of this medium.
At the end of the day, everybody has to turn the pipe. That's really all that matters.
Yeah, just keep it turning.
That's what Ethan's students are doing. He picks up a new pole and offers it to one of them.
As long as you keep it turning, it should stay nice and smooth.
The glass flowers are blooming into a beautiful bouquet, along with plenty of poetic metaphors. Trying things out, making mistakes, surprising yourself, helping your friends, and letting them help you all seem to be a part of the glass-making practice. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Blair Salyer for Cross Currents. Molly reported that story as a fellow in our Audio Academy, and if you're interested in learning how to make radio just like that, guess what? Applications are now open for the next class. Go to klw.org/audioacademy for all the details. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba.
Earlier this year, the San Francisco Unified School District announced it'll need to cut costs to address their budget deficit and declining enrollment. The cuts could result in school closures. As part of their decision-making process, they're inviting the public to a series of community conversations to solicit their input. To understand how this'll work and what it all means for the future of San Francisco's public schools and students, KLW executive producer Ben Trefney had a conversation with SFUSD Superintendent Matt Wayne.
I'm a teacher at heart, and it's why I got into education. And so the fact that as a district now, we're focused on outcomes for literacy, math, and college and career readiness is incredibly important. School districts across the country got an infusion of resources during the pandemic. Those are now going away. And so we have to make some tough decisions about how we're using those resources to provide the educational opportunities our students deserve.
So the San Francisco Unified School District is facing a $100 million plus budget deficit, right, for the upcoming fiscal year. How do you see how we got to this situation?
We're facing what's often termed in education a fiscal cliff, where the funding we got from the pandemic, what's called ESSER funds and other funds, they are running out. And then also we received a reduced cost of living adjustment from the state. And so we are facing declining resources. So we're doing our budget planning right now to achieve the $103 million in reductions we need for our unrestricted general fund. But by making the reductions, we'll need to identify probably another $50 million for the subsequent year. Just in the past 7 years, we've have 4,000 fewer students than we did in 2017-18.
Which used to be more than 50,000.
Yeah, so we went from over 53,000 to now about 49,000 students in the district. And so every time a student leaves, that's, you know, $15,000 less we get for our budget. And students don't leave in groups of 20 where we can just say, okay, we're going to offer one fewer class. It's spread throughout the district. That's been a major factor in our budget deficit. And then the other factor is we're also going through a process to decide where do we want to invest our resources, recognizing with the one-time funding going away, with the declining enrollment, we need to determine how we're going to use our resources. And so we've given meaningful salary increases, a historic increase to our teachers and educators. And we felt that was critical to do because we're facing a teacher shortage in the state and in the country. And, you know, I think sometimes when administrators like myself say resource alignment, it could sound like a euphemism for something else, but it truly is what we're doing. We now have these goals. And we know what kind of educational experiences we want to provide for our students. And so how do we use what's available to us to do that? And how we are supporting our schools and our school portfolio hasn't changed. And so that's what we need to address. And when I say our circumstances have changed, that's the declining enrollment that we face, the increase in costs to fix all of our facilities. So now as we're going through our budgeting process for next year, we are impacting actual positions at the central office and at our schools. So what we did is we put forward a plan this year for school staffing and budget that tried to be very transparent about what we're committed to, and then also where schools are going to have discussions about what they want to prioritize. And so, but what we're committed to are having, you know, our classrooms fully staffed, to having support for improving instruction. What we did say is we're also going to staff our classrooms, though, based on the agreements we have with our teachers union. So we call that staffing to contract. And we think we can still offer, you know, our elementary students, for example, a great education when there's, you know, 20 students in the class, or at middle and high school when there's, you know, 30 or 33 students in the class. And we've had through the district, because of the declining enrollment, a lot of small classes and classes even of 10, 11, 12 kids. And it'd be one thing if we, by design, said, you know what, this is what we need to do to be able to meet our literacy goal. But that's not how it's played out. And so we're really trying to be more strategic and saying, you know, no, we're going to staff at the level where we think we can provide a great education and then provide that support for teachers to improve instruction and support for, you know, kids on their socio-emotional learning.
So if you have some classrooms that are smaller, I guess that some of those could be combined in schools. I know that there's, say, like some schools that have like fourth, fifth grade classrooms, for example, and maybe if you have two, there are 10 students each, and that creates a 20-student classroom, so you have fewer faculty who needs to be present for that, right? So that's a cost savings without necessarily an education loss. But also one of the conversations about, around resource alignments around schools that are, say, have fewer students than they used to.
Yeah. So as I said, our circumstances have changed, but our school portfolio hasn't. So we've lost 4,000 students, but we still have 120 schools in this district. So we have some buildings that can only take, 275, 300 kids. But we have buildings that could have 500, 600 kids, and they have half of that now because of the declining enrollment. And so we're saying we really need to step back and look at what's the appropriate number of schools to operate in order to meet our goals for student outcomes? Because really, we're not about trying to maintain buildings. It's trying to figure out how to maintain the best educational experience for our students. So we are launching that conversation now about what our school portfolio should look like and being transparent. But what do we want to make sure that we're committed to offering throughout the city to both address all of our students' academic needs and make sure that we're following through on our commitments to educational equity. So it's been since the early 2000s that we've closed schools, and that was a difficult process for the city. It was done quickly and without much community input, and that it disproportionately impacted communities that already in the city have been underserved. And so what we're doing is we're going through a process where we're really going to engage the community to set the criteria for our new school portfolio. So that's a process that we feel is incredibly important because, you heard me say, we have a commitment to educational equity. So that will be one of the criteria we use to make sure we don't disproportionately impact one community through this process. So we have a lot of important community conversations happening over the next several months. We're going to be starting on March 28th with the town hall, and then we'll be out at 8 schools throughout the district over the next week. So we're going to have that conversation first in the next week, sharing the initial criteria, and then we'll get the feedback from our community and what's important. What should we really be looking at? Then we'll go back out in the beginning of May and share, here's what we heard from you. Then we'll get more feedback. And then over the summer is when we'll actually put together the recommendations to release in the fall. Our 8 community meetings to be in all parts of the city. And then we also are asking our school leaders to share the criteria at their school and get feedback in their school communities. Because in the end, where do families interact with schools? It's at their school site more often than at the district. And so we're going out and about to see if we can communicate with as many people as possible. We have a ton of partners who work across the city. So we're talking to them to say, hey, you need to help us get families out to be a part of this conversation. So it's a real intentional effort to reach everyone, and particularly those whose voices we may not hear if we didn't take this extra step to ensure that they're included in the conversation.
And so who makes the calls ultimately for which schools to close as part of the resource alignment?
We're going to bring forward recommendations in the fall. And so when I say we, this is a staff job to take in all the community input and put together those recommendations based on the criteria. We are also partnering with Stanford to do an equity audit to make sure, again, that it doesn't disproportionately impact one community. And so then we bring those forward in the fall to share with the community and start talking with those schools that will be impacted, and we'll make any adjustments necessary. But then ultimately, it's the Board of Education's decision that will be brought forward to them in December to make on what our new school portfolio looks like. The Board of Education understands that this is what we have to do now in order to set really future generations of San Francisco students for success. And so even though the timing is around the election, whether we were doing this now or not, it's part of the public conversation in San Francisco.
Is there anything that you think people might be missing about how you and the district are dealing with the budget deficit?
I just want to make sure people keep in mind is that we have amazing programs. We offer so many unique experiences in San Francisco. And the reason why we're going through this process is to be able to continue to do that. And in fact, offer even more. So for example, we have wonderful language programs in the district. You know, many districts do dual immersion with Spanish dual immersion. We also have Chinese dual immersion. We also offer world language programs in Korean, in Tagalog for our Filipino students. And we want to do those. Right now, though, those are spread throughout the district. We haven't stepped back and say, if we're committed to offering these programs, how do we do that in a sustainable way? That's what we want to do. So just as an educator, I want us to do it right the first time and not have to worry about having all these interventions. And then I also just want to provide those experiences that think about when you were a student that you remember going through schools. And that's what's so neat about being in San Francisco is what the opportunities our kids have, you know, are in middle school that I hear in other places only, you know, college kids get to do, or you couldn't do anywhere else because we're in San Francisco.
That was SFUSD Superintendent Matt Wayne speaking with KALW Executive Producer Ben Trefney. If you want to join the conversation about the future of SFUSD, they'll be hosting their first meeting online tomorrow. We'll have a link at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Next up, El Cerrito author Maya Ely gives guidance on how to talk about anti-Black racism. It's our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals.
It's an illustrated visual glossary that provides high-level definitions of terms and historical events to aid in understanding race and the Black experience in America. The term respectability politics refers to the tactic used by African Americans and other marginalized groups to distance themselves from stereotypes about their ethnicity. They self-police to behave and present themselves in a manner that will result in being treated as an equal by the white majority. Most Black children are raised learning many hard truths. Don't ride with the music too loud. Don't walk around with your hood up. Make sure to speak English eloquently. Don't appear too Black. The lesson, they will have to work twice as hard as white children to have a chance of being seen and treated equally, is the marginalized version of America's classic meritocracy ideology. If you just work hard enough, you'll succeed. However, respectability did not stop Harvard graduate Christian Cooper from being racially profiled and having the police called on him while he was birdwatching in Central Park. It didn't stop the shooting of Philando Castile by the police when he was being cooperative and disclosed that there was a licensed firearm present in the car. Behaving respectably will not protect Black people from racism, physical violence, or emotional harm.
That was El Cerrito author Maya Ely. Her book, The Anti-Racist Vocab Guide, came out in January. New Arrivals is produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse. You can find that episode and more at kalw.org/newarrivals. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear how an Oakland pastor has turned the tables on homophobia in the church.
If this God thing is not healing people and helping people, if all it's doing is condemning people and sending them to destruction and threatening them and yelling at them and screaming at them and telling them what they're not and telling them what they can't do and what they can't be, if that's all it's good for, then I think we ought to all just go pick peanuts and drink red soda pop or something and give up on this because it's useless.
Doing no harm. That's tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Pat McMahon, James Rollins, Gonadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Sunni Khalid. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.